Hey guys, this episode of the Crack Podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included in your Squarespace website. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, set your website apart. I've been down so long, it look like up to me. They look good to me. I got fake people showing fake love to me. Straight up to my face. Straight up to my face. Something ain't right when we talking. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Crack Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Crack. And this week, we're listening to Fake Love by Drake, which is appropriate because we're releasing this the day before the election. An election that has one half of the country threatening to move to Canada, Drake's home country, if they lose, and the other half threatening to start a civil war if they don't win. This song is about relationships that look okay from the outside but are secretly fucked up, which I'd argue is a fair characterization of probably how most people felt about our country prior to this election. We're okay, right, guys? But the subject of this episode is specifically that civil war that Trump supporters seem to be threatening to start. What's so civil about war anyways, right? Am I right? To quote the great thinker Axl Rose in the profoundly stupid but actually pretty epic Guns N' Roses song Civil War. Not good enough to play here, though. Sorry, Axl. But yeah, we wanted to close out this election by talking about the very worst of the many paths that America might head down, depending on the outcome of tomorrow's election. Robert Evans spoke with a bunch of military and political thinkers who know stuff about political uprisings and civil wars, and they told Evans that if the chips fall in just exactly the wrong way, a sequel to the Civil War is possible. Now, it's way more likely that this podcast ends up being an immediately outdated historical document, like an email sent the day before Y2K about our future without air travel or whatever we thought was going to happen on Y2K. I don't even remember. But even if America doesn't go to hell this week, this can, I guess, serve as a historical document of how dark shit got during this election. The longer it went on, the more the NPR and mainstream media pundits started sounding like naive to me in their astonishment that Trump would threaten not to accept the results of the election. Dude has been bragging about his dick size since the first Republican debate. He doesn't give a fuck about your sense of decorum. But I will say that this election has made me way less likely to take anything about our electoral process for granted, like that the losing candidate does typically offer a faux, gracious concession speech. Like, as the editor-in-chief of a humor site, I thought that was just an awkward public ritual that was fun to make fun of. Turns out those are important. Those are what we have instead of civil wars in most elections, or what we used to have if things don't go quite as well tomorrow. Anyways, here is my conversation with Robert Evans and Teresa Lee about Robert's article from earlier this week that painted a really vivid portrait of what I'd argue is the worst case scenario for a lot of people. Maintaining the status quo might look like the worst case scenario for those people, I guess. If status quo is your worst case scenario, I think you won this election. I think the status quo got the shit kicked out of it this election. I don't think there's any version of the future where things just kind of pop back into their previous shape like a wrinkle-resistant shirt. Random. Anyways, to understand why I think there's no going back, let's get right into it. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. That's when they smile in my face. Whole time they want to take my place. Whole time they want to take my place. Whole time they want to take my place.
take my place. I could tell that love is fake. All right, I'm joined in studio by Rob Evans. Hey, Rob.
That's not my name.
Hi, Robert. Bert.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome. And Teresa Lee.
Hey, what up?
Hey.
You can call her Risa.
Nah, I'm good. Larissa T.
There we go.
On Twitter. We're talking about Civil War on today's episode. Robert has traveled to Civil Wars and talked to a lot of military experts on the subject. And I've watched well over half of Ken Burns's Civil War documentary. So we're experts on the subject.
Yeah, my favorite part of that Ken Burns documentary is when Iron Man punched Captain America just right in the jaw.
No, but you did travel to the Ukraine. Did you go there or you just spoke with them?
No, I traveled there. I was in a city called Adivka that was kind of right on the place that's seceded, essentially, is centered around a city called Donetsk. And I was in a suburb of that place that was being shelled from the city and they were shelling back. And so that was where. And I talked to a lot of people who lived in and around the areas that were being affected and hit and who'd been, you know, a lot of people who'd been tortured and just by people who'd been their neighbors a week or two before and people whose houses had been blown up. And the overwhelming sentiment that all of them expressed to me was like, I can't believe this is happening. This doesn't seem like possible. Like if you told me 2 years ago this would be happening in my country, I'd tell you you were crazy. And I even encountered similar sentiments in northern Iraq talking to people who'd lost their homes to ISIS. Just like, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe it got this bad. Like, sure, we're used to some amount of violence, but the fact that things have gone this badly, this fast, was shocking to them, too. Which is why I kind of figured maybe we should take at least the possibility seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think in America we generally, like, relegate civil wars to things that happen in foreign countries and sepia-toned black and white photographs, but there has been, for instance, in the Ukraine or in Iraq, they have had periods of peace or non-civil war that lasted longer than the period between the 1860s and today. And throughout this exercise in imagining a modern-day civil war in America, I kept thinking of the movie Red Dawn because I grew up in the 80s, and that's like the closest that I could come to like thinking about a military operation being run in like the American suburbs.
One of the interesting things about America is that we're always terrified of what other people might do to us, but like inevitably the worst things that have ever happened to America have all been done by Americans to Americans. Like we lost more people in our Civil War than we've lost in all the other wars we've ever fought. We lose more people to mass shootings than we ever will to foreign terrorism. Like there's never been anyone who's as dangerous to America as Americans. And I think that's one of the reasons why this is such a compelling topic to me, because if something really terrible happens to this country in my lifetime, I think it's going to be us doing it to ourselves.
Well, you made an interesting point in the article about, or somebody talked about high school football, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, you asked, well, wouldn't it be hard to get Americans to like demonize each other or villainize each other that much? And
yeah,
they were like, have you seen like high school football rivalries?
Yeah, that was Colonel David Kubalon, who was a governor of the Wasit province in Iraq during 2003-2004. And he pointed out to me that with any sort of war, your goal or one of the ways in which you motivate soldiers is by kind of demonizing the enemy. That just happens in every war to every group of people. And I was like, well, it doesn't seem likely that Americans would be able to demonize other Americans in the same way that we did, you know, the Japanese or the Germans in World War II. And he pointed out, like, well, look at what high school football teams do to each other. Come on, man, it ain't hard.
Even within high schools, like, girl groups are, like, mean to each other.
What?
What?
Or within Cracked. I mean, we all hate the video team.
Yeah, we all hate each other.
Yeah, the editorial team and the video team are always walking up to each other, snapping, and then getting into switchblade fights. Podcasts kind of go on either
like
side.
Switzerland.
Just nobody. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. No switchblades in the podcast room.
Because a lot of the things that are happening in the news recently kind of reminded you of the stuff that was happening in other countries that then went to civil war. You took this very seriously and like talked to a bunch of different military experts and historians and kind of put together an article that was pretty authoritative and thoroughly researched on how an American Civil War could happen in the modern world and what it would look like.
Yeah, and one of the things that surprised me most, I sometimes have trouble reaching out, especially to like really authoritative academic sources, because they're like, well, cracked, you're a comedy website, I don't want you making fun of me, and I have to then explain to them for a long time before they'll talk to me, like, no, we're not going to joke with you, we seriously want to know what you think. This time I didn't have any trouble at all. Everyone I reached out to, including like a guy, David Kilcullen, who's the former chief strategist for the State Department's counterterrorism office, one of the guys, the architects of the surge in Iraq, like they all got right back to me. No one said, yeah, I think it's likely that a civil war is going to happen, but everyone was concerned enough about the possibility that they took it seriously and wanted to talk about it seriously. Kilcullen specifically said, like, I would say we're in sort of a proto-insurgency situation. I think that's one of the most important things that came out of this is like when you think like about a civil war, you think about the last civil war we had where it's two big groups of guys in very clearly different uniforms shooting at each other in a field. But that's not how war happens anymore anywhere, really. Like if another civil war came to the U.S., it would look like what it looks like in, you know, Iraq or Ukraine, where it's small groups of armed partisans primarily attacking targets of opportunity, terror attacks, trying to destabilize the government in the region so that they can provide some sort of order. Like it would be a series of little brushfire conflicts and there would be hundreds of sides probably. Like that's the kind of thing that you could expect rather than like one big split between the North and the South. You'd have, you know, a little rebellion breakout here or an insurgency breakout here. And then suddenly there's just a bunch of, it would look like a lot of mass shootings or terrorist attacks, all with the goal of destabilizing the economy and reducing sort of people's trust in the government, which is really the goal of any sort of insurgency, is to stop people from trusting the government to keep them safe.
Yeah, it seems like the way that it was being described in your article and the way the military experts were describing it, it's the sort of thing that our media would never characterize as a civil war in our case. Like if it was happening in an African country, they'd be like, this country's at war with itself. But in America, they'd just call it terror attacks or whatever.
Yeah.
Over and over again.
It would seem like a bunch of terror groups had suddenly leapt up into the country. And you're already seeing a bunch of sort of right-wing militias talking about like, well, we think there's going to be bloodshed if Trump doesn't win the election. And, you know, most of them, almost all of them are probably blustering. Anybody who's willing to talk about it openly on the internet is probably full of crap. But there's also definitely guys who are violent and dangerous and who aren't doing it on the internet. You know, I spoke to a Homeland Security expert, David Johnson, who quit the Department of Homeland Security after releasing a big report saying, like, we need to take right-wing militias more seriously, and white nationalism more seriously. This is a big and growing problem, and it's going to be an increasing cause of violence in the United States. And the government kind of ignored it. Congress sort of got angry at Homeland Security for even writing up the report because they said that it was too politically motivated and they were trying to slam conservatives, which is not what they're doing. You're just pointing out there's a lot of armed groups of angry people out there. And we just saw a black church burn down. Who knows who it was, but there's been increasing, there's
come
more
on,
militia
bro, that was
now.
Clearly a false flag operation, according to Reddit. Yeah, there was a black church burned down and someone spray painted vote Trump on it, and people were like, ah, Clinton, clearly trying to frame Trump. Yeah, it is really interesting that if the Oklahoma City federal building had been blown up by Al-Qaeda, we would still be at war with Al-Qaeda. Like, we would have never stopped going after them. We would have gone to war with their entire ethnic group,
yeah.
Like, for the past 20 years. But it was blown up by a white nationalist militia guy who we put him to death, but his type of people just took over a federal building with, yep, like weapons, and as you pointed out in your article, pooped everywhere.
Yeah, they pooped all over the place.
Why did they do that?
Is that out of necessity, or was that like a cat being passive aggressive?
I don't think they were good at camping.
Okay.
And one of the things that was pointed out to me by David, David Kilcullen, who spent a lot of time in internet communities of these groups, talking to members of these militias, is that a lot of the people he spoke with were very angry that these guys had done it, not because they disagreed with what the dudes at Malheur were doing, but because they hadn't prepared properly. Like, if you're going to try and spark something like that, some sort of civil conflict, you want to have a bigger underground built up. And that's kind of the thing that's lacking now. Like, we have groups of armed and angry people all around the country who want some sort of radical change. And they're both on the left and the right. This isn't just a right-wing militia thing. There are a number of left-wing groups that feel the same way.
Yeah.
What they don't have, what none of them really have yet, or at least what we're hoping they don't have yet, is what it takes to keep an insurgency alive, which is a large underground of people in the media and in civilians who are willing to both speak positively about them, help propagandize for them, hide people, feed people, supply them with food and ammunition. Like, that's the thing that we're lacking right now. And the thing that it would take to make that happen is people get angry enough at the government and have enough trust in this group as a sort of replacement that they were willing to support that. So that's kind of the thing that we lack. And as long as that doesn't happen, we're probably safe. But we're closer to that happening than I think anybody really wants to admit. But it's just clear looking at the news, people are furious. And I think a lot of times they're furious, not necessarily with great information, but like you can see it on the left and the right, people who think like the whole system is rigged, you know, our government's illegitimate, whether it's Hillary or Trump, they're both demons. You know, it's definitely like you can see how we might be at the starting line for something like this.
You had this quote, he was saying that in, I think it was in Iraq, we fought 170 different groups.
That was David Kilcullen was pointing out to me that during the time he was working in Iraq, there were 170 different militia groups essentially working against the coalition efforts. And a lot of those groups had disagreements. There were Sunni and there were Shia who hated each other, but they were willing to work together or at least not directly attack each other all that often because they understood that if they were all fighting against the United States, they were stronger. Like, it's one insurgency is way weaker, even if it's massive, than 1,000 tiny ones, because 1,000 tiny ones is just a game of whack-a-mole. Bill Fulton was putting out that, and he's a militia expert, he's gone undercover in a number of these working with the FBI. He says there are about 300-ish groups that he's concerned about in the United States that he thinks have not just have a bunch of armed people, but also have an ideology that's got sort of deep enough roots that he thinks they might be willing to actually fight and die for it. He was pointing out, you don't want to look for like flash in the pan groups. Like, it's not going to be someone who just formed up. Like, it's not going to be the Trump movement that starts anything. It might be people who like Trump, but they're going to be members of groups that have existed for 20, 30 years that have some really deep roots to their belief system.
Like white nationalists who have been raised as white nationalists and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Other than like, I know what the white nationalists want, but all these other groups, like going into a revolution, I guess, I can see us heading towards it in terms of like the chaos, but on the other end, what are they envisioning? That's the part I'm not getting. Like, what do they see if they win coming out of that? Like, what is the thing they're trying to build other than like all white people? Are there other ideologies that
would be such a change too, all white people and the government? Could you imagine such a thing?
It would be unimaginable, Jack.
Right.
I mean, there's black nationalist groups, black separatist groups. Gavin Long, who shot those six police officers, killed three of them in Baton Rouge, was a black separatist. You don't tend to see those guys. They're certainly not as vocal, because anytime they say something about wanting to overthrow the government, the FBI gets involved immediately. Like, it's not, we don't ignore that like we do militias. And I think one of the things that was pointed out to me is that, you know, left-wing groups were a lot more violent in the 60s and 70s, and they were pretty brutally slapped down. Also, some of them blew themselves up, like the Weathermen. But that was like a significant thing for like 15, 20 years, was violent left-wing Symbionese Liberation Army and all that stuff. Like, that was a big deal for a while. And we've kind of forgotten about it because these right-wing groups have gotten much louder. But a lot of those guys and those groups are still there in some form, and they all have goals and desires and ambitions too. Like, it's kind of an opportunistic thing. Like, as soon as, if it were to start, if one or two insurgencies were to kick off and to actually stay alive for more than a couple of days, you would see other groups kind of trying their luck. And I think a lot of it would be inspired by the police crackdown, because any kind of like, look what happened after the Boston Marathon bombings and all those neighborhoods that suddenly had tanks rolling through them and police forcing everyone to stay inside. And look at what happened in Ferguson when the rioting started. Like, there's immediately a strong and aggressive law enforcement presence. And I think that has a tendency, or could have a tendency, to inspire more violence. Like, if people get frustrated enough with that, like it's one of those things where it would be like a set of dominoes falling. And that's the real worry. And so you can say like, well, it doesn't look likely because all of these things would have to happen for there to be anything that could really be considered a civil war. And you're right, it is unlikely. But also, it's an old story in history where one seemingly little thing happens and then it kicks off a cascade effect that burns everything to the ground. That's how we got World War I.
So, in other words, it would be like the thing that happened in Boston happens, they shut down the city, but instead of just being two brothers who are just like building bombs as they go, it's like an entire militia group that like starts a battle with the police and the military, and then a different underground group sees their opportunity because the military and the police are busy fighting some group, and so they come in from the other direction. The statistic that shocked me was that there are an estimated 1,360 radical militias and anti-government groups in the U.S. in 2012, and that there were only 149 4 years before.
Yeah.
So what the fuck? Is it just Obama? Is it just racism?
I think it's us. Like, not cracked just. I mean, I'd love it if we had that much influence. Maybe we made
exactly
one or two of them happen.
That's exactly how many employees we have, yeah.
But I think it has a lot to do with the media. Just because the most exciting stuff sells, the stories that seem like, America, look at what Obama's doing to destroy America. Look at how Hillary Clinton hates our veterans. Look at how Donald Trump, you know, wants to spark a revolution. And
Robert's
so get
reading those off the front page of Cracked right now. All of those are just first, second, and third headlines.
But I think, like, the media has a lot to do with how angry people have gotten, because it's really done a lot to blow our sense of perspective just completely out of the water. And I think there are a lot of people who believe that our national situation is much worse than it is. I think there's a lot of people who believe that the other side, so to speak, is much worse than they are. And I think that's had a lot to do with how all these groups have sparked up. But it's also the internet. Like, it was harder to form a militia or anti-government group before you could do it online, before you could meet with like-minded people and plan via the internet. Like, that's made all of this a lot easier.
Militias used to be a thing in, like, a small town. Like, yeah. Everybody in a small town would get together and be like, let's bury all of our guns underground,
yeah,
or something. And, you know,
the Russians.
Prepare just in case, yeah, the Russians or some liberal democratic president comes for our guns. But it was, like, based on geography. Like, okay, I happen to be around a bunch of people who have the same politics as me. And the internet makes it possible for people to find each other. And then the other really scary thing about the internet, I sound very old, is one of the military experts that you talked to was talking about how a standard trait of insurgencies has always been in the past that they have really poor communication. They can't communicate in real time with one another because they have to stay underground and be quiet and hide essentially from the big bad government. But I think there was a terror attack in somewhere overseas a couple years ago where they were using CNN as their eyes and ears.
I think you're talking about the Mumbai shootings.
Yes. They just had like a live feed of the media's coverage of their terror attack, and we're using that as like surveillance to defend against the police and military.
And I think another way the media might help that sort of cascade effect that we were talking about kick off is it's copycat attacks are, at this point, it's a well-studied phenomenon, to the point where they know that if there is a mass shooting like the Aurora shooting or whatever that gets a huge amount, more media attention than a normal mass shooting, within 2 weeks there's going to be at least one and often more than one copycat attacks. Huh. Like, that's just a thing. Like, they've studied sort of the propensity for copycat attacks to be carried out for years now, and it's a well-studied phenomenon. And we've even seen in the aftermath of ISIS starting to cut a lot of people's heads off, a lot more stories have cropped up about people cutting off other people's heads, sometimes as part of a terror attack, sometimes just as part of a crime. But there are a few experts who sort of suspect that this is because of something, like this is an example of that copycat effect. Like, people hear about this on the news, it's in their head, and so, you know, there may be a person who's already going to do something crazy, but they decide to do something crazy that takes this form because it's what they're seeing in the news and it's what they know gets attention. It's like Omar Mateen, the guy who shot up that nightclub in Florida. If ISIS had never happened, there's a very good chance he would have carried out a mass shooting somewhere. He was a crazy, angry person who was probably going to do something terrible if he had access to the equipment to do it. But he allied himself with ISIS just because that was, he knew that, I mean, I think he knew that was the best way to get the most attention. I think that was a big cause at the time that was like sexy in his eyes. That's something any insurgent movement that starts up in the United States would be able to count on, is that if they carry out a couple of high-profile attacks and have a, you know, a lot of it would be like their marketing, whether or not they're able to get a name that people recognize, and they're like, you know, this is who we are and this is our ideology, it would be easy for them to attract other people to commit attacks that don't cost them any resources, that don't take them any planning, that don't put them at any risk. People are just going to do stuff like that because that's something we do in America, is some people are always going to carry out crazed attacks on other people. And if you give them something to ally with that lets them feel like they're part of a bigger movement, a lot of them are going to want to do that.
Didn't ISIS change their name too? So they did sort of rebrand a little?
I mean, ISIS ISIS was originally Al-Qaeda in Iraq, although they were never really an Al-Qaeda affiliate. This guy, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, essentially started his own terror organization in Iraq, and he was a big fan of Osama bin Laden. And Osama bin Laden hated him, because Osama bin Laden doesn't believe that it's ever okay to carry out attacks against other Muslims. And Zarqawi was like, no, you can kill whoever the hell you want as long as it's in the greater cause of jihad. But his group got big enough that Al-Qaeda was like, well, we got to let him use our name because this is the biggest insurgent group in Iraq right now. And then we killed Zarqawi and we thought we'd wiped out the network, but they really just kind of kept going underground for years and years until they popped up and rebranded themselves as the Islamic State and the new caliphate and all that stuff.
And so that's why people were mad when that group came out and like made an attack without being more prepared, is what ISIS did essentially, is like what militia groups want their fellow militiamen to do, is like just stay underground, do a lot of preparation, and then attack.
There's a book that you can read. Everyone listening to this can go find it online right now and read it. It's called The Management of Savagery, and it's essentially the blueprint that ISIS used to establish their quote-unquote caliphate. One of the things Kilcullen pointed out to me is that The Management of Savagery was particularly likely to be used as sort of the blueprint of an insurgency, because most of the people behind any left or right-wing insurgent movement in the United States are likely going to be military veterans, because those are the people with the skills and the talent to do this. And, you know, most military veterans obviously have no desire to do anything like that, but all it takes is a couple of crazy ones with the talent and the skills to organize a group of armed people. And they're going to use the tactics that are most, and you can find, you know, it took me 20, 30 minutes to find militia groups online talking about using Taliban style or Al-Qaeda style tactics in their hypothetical war with the government. It's definitely something these people are planning on. It's something they're aware of, and it works. Like, we know that it works because we've seen how hard it is to fight an insurgency that goes by these tactics. And essentially all The Management of Savagery says is that you have to destabilize the country first by carrying out a series of attacks and provoking a series of copycat attacks, provoking other groups to rise up and carry out attacks. And if you can just destabilize the country enough, then you come in and offer a sort of organization. And that is like the fastest way to actually like take land as an insurgency rather than carry out endless attacks. And it worked really well in Syria and in Iraq. As soon as things got destabilized enough that the central government didn't have strong control over a region, ISIS, that's why it seems like they came out of nowhere, because this strategy works incredibly well. As long as you have a large, dedicated group of armed people that you can, you know, use to enforce it.
Yeah, I guess I'm having a hard time getting my head around the idea that, let's say, a white nationalist movement starts carrying out all these attacks and they're incredibly violent. Why would that cause anybody to feel less confident in our government? It feels like we would side with the government more. But I guess what you're saying is that white nationalists do a bunch of terror attacks and then like other kind of militia groups do terror attacks, and then because the government strikes back with a lot of violence, then like people are scared of the government too, or how does that work?
Think about what happened in Los Angeles, what was it, 2-3 years ago,
riots.
When that special forces veteran got loose in the city basically, and the police gunned down 2 or 3 people just trying to catch this guy. Like, look at what happened with the Branch Davidians. Look at how much anger that rose up when they, I mean, these guys were nuts. They were doing terrible things to kids. But also the government burnt like 80-something of them to death, and that immediately like ignited a lot of the militia movement, is that action against the Branch Davidians. And those militia guys weren't Branch Davidians. They weren't that strain of you know, militant Christianity.
So that's the key part of the equation, is that it's not the attack by the anti-government group. It's the government sort of clapback that makes people think, oh, that was like too much force. And like, obviously the government is never the underdog.
Yeah.
So.
Right. You don't have to convince them that you're right. You have to convince them that the government is not right. Then they have an inroad. I want to pull up the quote from David Kuvalon, because I think he did a great job. If you undermine the moral authority that the government or the military or the police forces have, you win. Then they become the enemy to everybody. It may not goad you into an armed insurgency, but it will goad you into a certain acceptance. And once the guerrillas reach acceptance, they have a path to win.
Yeah, because it's also like, if the anti-government groups are using violence or they kill people, we expect that. But as soon as one innocent person is like in the collateral damage, then we all hate the government.
I also think we're kind of primed by a lot of our fictional media to be more sympathetic to these guys, whether they're, like, if you're on the left, you'll find the left-wing violent militias more sympathetic. If you're right, you find the right-wing militias more sympathetic. But they're all going to be more sympathetic than a bunch of police officers or military people tromping through the streets in giant armored vehicles looking like stormtroopers. Because I think we're kind of coded to think that the rebels, the guys wearing like the cowboy looking clothes and, you know, fighting in the woods, as more of the good guys than the giant, well-armed and armored, faceless imperial stormtroopers. Like,
right.
That's
the guys with the helicopters. Yeah. It's hard to root for them.
It's hard to root for them.
But I mean, it would be easy for me to root for them if they were fighting against right-wing militias who were white nationalists. But another thing that somebody pointed out in the article was that one of the people who shot three cops in response to one of the police shootings, mm-hmm, was part of a black separatist movement, but he shared beliefs with like some
sovereign
right-wing
citizens.
Yeah, sovereign citizens, which was like a right-wing militia group. So that's the thing that I guess I hadn't taken into account, and that was making it hard for me to get my mind around this, is that like, these groups are not picky, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like they all have one common enemy, and that enemy is the government.
I think the most likely path isn't that any one of these guys seizes power in some kind of grand coup, but it's like what happened in Germany in 1933. What you had prior to the Nazis coming into full power of the government was essentially an insurgency situation. You had armed political groups fighting in the streets, killing each other, taking over the capital. Berlin was taken over two or three times in the years after World War I, before World War II, by various different, essentially armed militia groups. And eventually the country got so destabilized, people had so little faith in the Weimar government, people had so little faith in the ability of the police and the military to protect them, that they were willing to go with the group that promised order and stability and safety. And as soon as the Nazis came into power, the crazy armed militia guys who had helped them do all the street fighting that brought them into power, they had them all killed. Because those guys are dangerous once you're in power. You don't want those guys hanging around when you're trying to run a government.
But what are they seen as? Because even in that version of history, like, there is the order. That's why they chose them. They wanted the order. So what are, I guess, in the current day, what are we seeing as the possibility after? I guess what I'm not getting is, like, what would be the America they envision after?
Now would be the perfect time for a Michael Caine impression saying, some men just want to see the world burn.
For one thing, I think that all that needs to happen for the government to be substantially destabilized is for a lot of people who want to create chaos and who hate the system to become active and violent against it. I don't know who would attempt to seize power. I expect there'd be a bunch of different groups and individuals who would attempt to seize power, who would attempt to prove that they could stop the violence or whatnot in that situation. I think one thing that everyone pointed out hasn't popped up yet is there's no sort of charismatic anti-government unifying leaders who actually want to burn down the system as it exists in a very meaningful way rather than working through it to achieve power. I mean, there's certainly people with those capabilities and that intelligence out there, but they're not the kind of folks who are going to post about it on the internet. That's the kind of thing you see after things have been destabilized badly. I don't think it would be if there were some sort of large-scale internecine violence that gripped the U.S. I don't think we would expect everyone in the country to be like, well, I guess we're going to join a white nationalist militia now. It would be whoever promises order and stability and seems to have a good way to deliver it. I did want to bring up something that you mentioned earlier, Jack, because you said, like, you're not going to find if a bunch of white militias start getting slammed down by the government, by the FBI or whatnot, or by the military, you're not going to be sympathetic to those guys. But look at what happened in Ferguson. Your sympathy probably, I'm going to guess it wasn't with the police in Ferguson.
Right.
Mine certainly wasn't. I think one of the important things to keep in mind, like when we look at the example of Germany, because it's such a great example of what happens when a well-educated, powerful democratic state falls in this sort of way, because that is exactly what happened in Germany, is that most of the people who put Hitler in power didn't really like Hitler and didn't want to put him in power, but they were terrified of the communists, who were this big, violent, anti-government group in their eyes, who had taken over the capital two or three times and had carried out all of these terrorist attacks. And the Nazis promised to destroy the communists. And so they were like, well, if they do this, then that'll end, and then we can vote the Nazis out of power and get back to being a normal country. Like, that's one of the ways in which this can all go.
I'm not really good with history. How'd that end up?
Germany seems nice to these days.
One of the things that we've talked about in recent episodes of this show that came up again in your article, when you were asking these experts how they would expect the lines to be drawn in a civil war. A lot of them said city versus rural, which really does seem to be the way that I would tend to be more sympathetic to a city group, a group of city radicals who are tired of, you know, the police oppressing them, than I would a rural group who are tired of the government oppressing them. So, yeah, I could definitely see that being the case. And that's, you know, something Jason Pargin said on the episode where we talked about the idea that red states and blue states aren't actually the dividing line. It's actually cities and country, was that as a person from the country, something that he was always aware of is that us city folk, you know, they can live without us. They can live without us making like fucking sitcoms. But
yeah,
if they decided to stop farming and making our food, we would die pretty quickly. And one of your sources said that we're only 9 meals from anarchy, which was a terrifying way for him to put that.
Yeah, and I think the point he was making is that the easiest thing for an insurgent group or a bunch of different insurgent groups to disrupt about our daily life would be our food supply. 90% of the food in the United States is transported by truck. Few truck bombings or a few roadside bombs that wipe out trucks, like that's going to, think of the chaos that'll cause. Think of how after 9/11 we just stopped traveling by planes for a couple of weeks. Like that just got shut the fuck down. If there were to be a concerted effort to carry out a roadside bombing campaign, it could do an unbelievable amount to disrupt our food supply, but also like our everything supply, because everything that gets to the cities and gets from city to city comes in trucks. And the destabilization that that would cause, as soon as there are food shortages, then you've got something that could provoke more violence, that could provoke more armed insurgent groups to get active. If you've got food shortages, you're probably going to have people marching in the streets. If you've got people marching in the streets, you're going to have police coming out to deal with the people marching in the streets. When that happens, you have pretty good odds that the police are going to do what the police tend to do, which is overreact to civilian aggression. And then you've got something that's potentially fueling, you know, more groups to carry out violent attacks. Like it's... Again, it's a cascade effect. If it happens, it's not going to be because like one evil genius decided to destroy the United States. It's going to be because one group of armed assholes or three or four different non-communicating groups of armed assholes start carrying out attacks, and then those attacks cause a cascade of effects that causes, you know, more destabilization and more violence.
I think the worst part, the worst outcome of what you just described would probably be that locavores and urban foragers would be like so smug about
it. I know,
so
we should all be starting rooftop gardens.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Victory really... gardens.
Right.
Oh God, is that what they call them now?
Yeah. That's what they called them in World War II.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to show you how to twerk the wheel. I'm going to show you how to twerk the wheel. Chrome on the feet, chrome pipes, chrome grill. Swing cock the wheel, hope my drink don't spill. Damn.
Hey guys, we're listening to Swangin', the song by Staley, or Staley and Scarface, that has one of my favorite little sample hook repeating things. I'ma show you how to twerk the wheel, chrome on the feet, chrome pipes, chrome grill, which I think is about cars, which was one of my favorite parts of Evans's article. Our civil war is gonna look like Mad Max, you guys. One of the military leaders was talking to Evans about specifically what the war would look like and said that our interstate highway system is a huge weakness for the empire, aka like the state, because most of our food comes in and out of our towns by truck, and it'd be easy to attack those trucks. So I don't know. It just gave me these really vivid images of military convoys on I-95 in the middle of nowhere, like accompanying grocery trucks and getting attacked on all sides by an army of dudes on ATVs with assault rifles. Anyways, hope you enjoy this song and enjoy these words from our sponsors. Damn. Grab my shelves and roll up, triple stack my cups up, Jolly Ranchers and Xanax, my special potion cola, my sheets feel like... You guys might remember back, 30 minutes ago, me mentioning a thing called Squarespace. That's because this episode of the Cracked Podcast is brought to you by them. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website for as low as $12 a month. But you've heard me say that. What does that mean? Well, in addition to their award-winning design that's so easy to customize that your grandma could do it, Squarespace offers 24/7 online customer support. Whenever you have just a question or just need someone to hold you, they'll give you a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. They probably won't hold you if you ask them to, but they are very nice people who are lovely to deal with. So yeah, start your free trial today with no credit card required, which is huge, at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED. Squarespace, set your website apart. Today's episode of the Cracked Podcast is sponsored by Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. I know that's a controversial thing to hear in America where you thought everything was created equal, but I'm going to shoot you straight here. Spicy mustard is just better than yellow mustard. I'm sorry. That's just the truth. What I'm trying to say here is Blue Apron sends you three amazing meals a week for less than $10 a meal, and they go out of their way to include only the best locally sourced and sustainably raised ingredients. Some of the meals they've prepared for November are pan-seared chicken with roasted fall vegetables and butter caper sauce. They've got a spicy lotus root and purple carrot stir fry with sweet potato noodles. And I know that those sound like those like fancy meals on a fancy restaurant's menu that just seems like they put the recipe together just so it sounded like sophisticated. But I've literally never had a recipe from Blue Apron that wasn't absolutely delicious. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/cracked. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Again, that's blueapron.com/cracked. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. My music jam, I'm banging screw. Shout out to my Houston crew. Uncle Bun and Scarface, the reason why my car laced with a detachable Alpine face. 15s and loud. We talked about on a recent episode, talked about the idea that we're at a turning point in history because of this election. And, you know, one of the possible outcomes is Trump loses and it's a close enough election that people think that it was stolen from him. And the people who would revolt are the people in the place that makes 99.9% of our food. So that is an actual possibility. It's not a very likely one. And they're also the people who would probably kick our ass in hand-to-hand combat. We talked about in a past episode that America is essentially made up of 11 nations. Like if you think of America as Western Europe, there are 11 different areas that are distinct ethnic groups that settled it. And the Southern Appalachian group is its own country. And they are people who are really good at living off the land and will fight you for literally anything. And that's where your sources thought the revolt would be most likely to start.
Yeah, David Kilcullen was like, if it starts, it's going to start in Southern Appalachia more likely than anywhere else. And that's when you're looking at the terrain in Southern Appalachia and you think about what it would take. Because one of the things people pointed out in the comments was like, well, if an insurgent group started, the U.S. military would stomp them down. First off, it would have to get really bad for the U.S. military to be allowed to intervene domestically. But second, how do you look at Appalachia? Look at how fucking, it's nothing but mountains and forest and tiny little isolated townships. You're looking at a situation that's not wildly dissimilar from Afghanistan in terms of, if in all of those states you have 2,000 people who are carrying out roadside bombing campaigns or 1,000 people, like, it would take a long time and an enormous amount of money for the government to stomp that out. those people know the area, they know the region. There's almost no police in a lot of that. You can drive for hours in a lot of those areas, and you're never going to see a cop car, or you see one maybe, because you've got a lot of little bitty townships that maybe just have a sheriff's department with two or three guys and militias. That's one of the things Bill Fulton pointed out, is that in a lot of these very rural areas, you've got, what, six people, a dozen people in the sheriff's department, and if you have a militia of 50 or 60, well, who's really in charge there, or who at least would be in charge if the militia decided to start fighting? Like, right. The police aren't going to tamp that down.
How many of the people in that police force are
sympathetic?
Sympathetic.
Sure.
Yeah, the portion of the country that was like built and settled by people who lived in the borderlands is what it was called in the 11 nations of America. So essentially people who didn't own any land because their land was dominated when they lived in Europe by war. So like in Scotland and Ireland, and they were just like constantly getting their ass kicked over there. So they were very warlike and also more likely to roam. They settled this tract of land called Greater Appalachia that has its own unique value system that is completely different from ours. And yeah, it goes basically from southern Ohio, southern half of Indiana, all the way down to northern Arkansas and Alabama and places like that.
Back to the subject of just sort of how the media has already primed people for any kind of fighting that's going to start. One of the, you know, when I wrote this article, I made a couple of jokes in there about like, and if you don't think a bunch of, you know, bearded Oxycontin popping hill people could defeat the U.S. government, you know, that's what's happening in Afghanistan right now. And I didn't even think of that as a slur. I thought I was making a joke about militia types, because I've known a lot of militia types, and quite a few of them are bearded Oxycontin popping hill people. But a lot of people in the comments got angry, saying, like, you're just furthering this divide between the rural and the cities, between these Trump supporters and not, by stereotyping them. I do feel bad about that, because I guess that was not my intent. But I think that is an example of the kind of behavior that, if we all keep doing it, could lead to some serious violence. If we keep stereotyping, and it is the same thing when someone on the right talks about latte-sipping liberals and lazy, worthless Californians and whatnot, like, it's dismissing millions of people because you disagree with them and think the things that they care about are silly, probably because you don't understand what their life has been like, because that's, you know, why we would dismiss them. I don't know. I think that's the thing that scares me most, is that we keep, and that's what's so scary about Trump News Network, if that winds up happening. Mm. Is that that's just going to further the divide, although you could also say on the other side of it, well, look at sites like Huffington Post that do nothing but slam the far right and equate all people on the right with these, you know, the nuttier movements on the fringe right. Like, it's all dangerous, and it could lead us to a really bad place if we don't get a handle on it.
I think on the last podcast, Jason was talking about when you're around people, they influence you. And on a smaller scale, I moved from New York last year, and I remember when I first moved here, I was like, I hate how happy everyone in LA is.
Right.
And a year later, I'm like, oh, I get it now. And I 100% would hate, like the me a year ago would definitely hate who I am now.
Yeah. But I remember when you first got here, you were like, hey, I'm walking over here.
Yeah, I was like, ah, pizza.
Pizza pie. Yeah.
That's stereotypical too, in Italians. No.
It is. We're all full of racists.
We all love pizza.
Yeah.
But on that note, like what you were saying, I thought that was interesting, because it's easier when you're in a place, obviously, when that's a smaller scale and it's not based on hate, it's just habits, mm-hmm. you know, like whether you like crystals or deli sandwiches, whatever. Those are just deli sandwiches.
Is that a big dichotomy?
Deli sandwiches.
Crystals
with
sandwiches.
Crystals on them. Oh, you have a crystal around your neck, you fucking hippie.
Oh, no, I've been caught. But yeah, I would never have worn a crystal in New York, definitely. But those are the little things that just, I think you adapt to where you are. And I can see that sort of on a larger scale being like divisive. Once you just, when you don't understand a way of life, it just becomes like antagonistic. But yeah. I had no reason to hate crystals. I just didn't like it because I didn't think
it was
cool.
A froofy West Coast thing. Yeah. I was listening to Dan Harmon's Harmontown podcast. He had a Norman Lear on, who's like the guy who basically invented television and created like Jeffersons and Sanford and Son, like 100 different shows all in the family. And he was pointing out, he's an old dude, and he was like 9 in the 1930s, and he was talking about the first time he listened to the radio, he tuned into Father Coughlin, who was this crazy racist, anti-Semitic, basically an American Nazi in the period before like Nazis became thought of as a bad thing by most Americans. And he talked about how much it terrified him, and the only thing that calmed him down was going to civics class, which is a thing we don't have anymore. But he said in civics class, they pointed out that the thing that really binds us all is this constitution and this shared, very basic set of values that ensures all of us a right to speak and all of these. And he's like, and that really comforted me, knowing that this guy was on the fringe and that really the values that unite us are our acceptance of the fact that everybody has the right to live a different life. And then he pointed out, I think it's a problem that we don't do that. We don't have those classes anymore. I did not go through any class when I was in school that's whole focus was to talk about our shared American values and the things that make us the reasons that we're one country rather than 7 or 11. And I think that's part of the problem too.
I blame public schools for most of my problems.
Yeah, I thought the gold rush was way more important than it is.
And the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. Something I learned too. Most of what I learned.
I forgot all science.
I mean, I pledged allegiance to the flag every morning, and that was enough for me. I didn't need no education besides that.
Yep, that and corn is maize.
Another sort of surprising thing that was pointed out is that I think a lot of people assume that militia groups are all unemployed people or, like, you know, really fringe, like farmers or whatever, just the worst stereotype you can think of. And your sources were pointing out that a lot of insurgencies are made of basically like small town doctors and lawyers and politicians and police chiefs and stuff like that. So it's like people who have social capital in their society and in their community, that is who ends up leading these uprisings. And so
a big part of why Hitler was as popular as he was initially is because he was a wounded combat veteran, war hero. He won the German equivalent of the Medal of Honor, and he won it legitimately. Like, he did some pretty incredible stuff in World War I. And Mussolini as well was a war hero. So it's people who had positions in society that entitled them to some amount of respect. Think about today, like, you hear some guy ranting about the government. If he's a dissatisfied, like, angry veteran who's been poorly treated by the VA or something, you're going to take him more seriously than if he's just some guy ranting on television. If it's, you know, former army sergeant or whatever, and he's got a chest full of medals, like, you're gonna listen to that guy. If he's a former school teacher, you're going to listen to that guy. It's why all those ads for whatever the hell they're ads for talk about, like, look at what this school teacher invented or whatever. It's because
Dr. Ben Carson.
Ben Carson. Yeah.
That is really interesting. There's like a weird counterbalancing thing where in the public world, people will be labeled the exact opposite. Like, Dr. Ben Carson is able to get away with being the least scientific public figure in the last 20 years. It's like when America started fighting wars of aggression instead of defense, we changed the name of our department from the War Department to the Department of Defense. That's something that Howard Zinn points out in a People's History of the United States. It's like there's just this way that you, I guess, lie. It's like the calculus of lies. Like, if somebody becomes famous for doing one thing, they'll probably get away with some crazy shit going in the other
reading,
direction.
Latte sipping, left coast liberal. Just to get us back.
I had
on
to read
slurs.
It for school. For I don't
your,
agree
for
with
your kooky
shit.
California schools.
I didn't go to school in California, bro. Kentucky.
Yeah, nobody who lives in California came from California.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, whose side would California fight on?
That's a good question. I mean, you already have, actually. One of the most powerful separatist movements in the United States is located in Northern California and parts of Southern Oregon. It's called the State of Jefferson, and it's kind of been a joke for most of its history, but I live up there now. Like, I live in rural Northern California and also rural Southern Oregon, and it's everywhere. The stamps are everywhere. The signs are everywhere. You'll see hundreds of houses with it on there, and there are now some fairly large and potent militia groups that claim to be the defense force of the State of Jefferson and whatnot. Like, it's a thing.
Yeah, I keep hearing about this.
I haven't heard of this.
Oh, really? And you're from the State of Jefferson, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm from the Bay, but the South Bay, so it's really tech country. I imagine there's not a big militia.
No, that's not quite State of Jefferson. So the State of Jefferson, the whole idea behind the movement is that it's north of San Francisco and really, like, south of Portland, and it's particularly California. But it's people who are like, well, San Francisco and Los Angeles and San Diego and Sacramento are these big, huge liberal cities with high taxes and strict gun laws, and that does not match our values. Because you go into, like, rural Northern California, and it's not wildly dissimilar to, like, I grew up in rural Texas and rural Oklahoma a lot. And it's very similar attitudes, more liberal in some things, but also I would say Northern California, rural Northern California, is more in common with Appalachia than it does with San Francisco, the Bay Area, with Los Angeles. And they're angry about the taxes. They're really angry about the strict gun laws in California. And they think that they should have their own state that's more focused on their more rural values, essentially, rather than a state that's dominated by all of the big cities in California. And they do have a point in that these people really don't have a voice in California politics, because there's not that many of them compared to, you know, whatever Los Angeles wants is what the state's going to do, because there's like 20 million people in the greater Los Angeles area, as opposed to a couple of million people, you know, living in the woods in NorCal. But they're very angry, they're very organized, and that's one of the things you would want to look at is like, who's going to try something in the event of some sort of civil conflict? Well, that's one area that would potentially be a brush fire.
And who's going to be better equipped to fight? Me or the people who have been planning to fight a war for the past 30 years that I was like laughing at on my podcast? But I really do think podcasts will be the main currency in our new state of nature.
Podcasts are the new bullets.
Right. Yeah.
One of the other things that was brought up a lot by all the experts I spoke to is that, like, it's not going to be every city and every state wouldn't be suffused in violence in our hypothetical civil war. There would be certain areas like Appalachia, like maybe like Northern California, parts of rural West Texas, where you would see the fighting start up. But that kind of fighting would have an impact everywhere, because think about like what one really big attack on New York City did to the whole national economy. It tanked us for a while. And that's the kind of thing that could, again, would lead to a loss of faith in government, would make people's lives bad enough that maybe more of them would join resistance movements, like all about that cascade.
Yeah, and I don't think people believe that. Like, I don't think people will believe if things get bad that they would stop trusting in the government, just because they've never been faced with that. But just thinking back to September 11th, it did like bring us all closer together, but that's because it was an outside.
It was a foreigner.
It was a foreigner. Now imagine that attack had been carried out by the state of Jefferson, and then the U.S. military had been, instead of carrying out the war on terror in the Middle East, they were carrying it out in California and accidentally blowing up Californians' homes. Then you suddenly have a much better case for civil war.
When people look at like what's going on in Iraq right now, they see it as this like army of evil that's arisen, this like terrorist army that's taken over part of the country, and the Iraqi military is fighting against them. And that's not really what's happening. One of the things that was made very clear to me on my visit earlier this year to northern Iraq is that what you really have there is a bunch of armed political parties vying for dominance, because there's no way, like, none of them have any faith in the ability of a free election to determine the future of the country. So the Shia band together in Shia militias, the Kurds band together in Kurdish militias, and in fact, the Peshmerga, which are probably the most effective military force in Iraq, are actually made up from armed groups of two political parties. There's two big political parties in Kurdistan right now, and they each control about half of the fighting forces there. And so, like, their military, the people who are kicking ISIS out right now, isn't a military in the sense that we have it. It's a political party. And ISIS, you can really look at as a Sunni separatist political party. And that's what happens when people have no faith in the ability of the government to ensure their rights in the event of an election, is that they take up arms as a way to sort of support those rights. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, because that's essentially what we'd be looking at. It wouldn't necessarily be everyone bands behind a white separatist group. It would be a group that promises, like, look, you can see all this violence. It's hurting your homes. It's hurting your communities. You know, we can protect them because we're in line with your ideas. And it would be the same thing with like black separatist militias. It's, you know, you can't trust the police to protect you, but we'll protect you because we're looking out for this community. We have your interests at heart. It's political groups taking up arms is what we could expect in any kind of insurgency, rather than a bunch of terrorist groups just suddenly trying to take over the country. It would be existing political organizations that are already present in our country, essentially forming militarized wings. And in fact, one of the things that one of the Civil War scholars I spoke with, Stathis Kalbius, who's a professor at Yale, pointed out is that one of the first things you see in any sort of civil war is political parties start recruiting military veterans and organized crime groups. because they need people who can train the rest of the movement in violence, because that's an important, and that's what you saw the Nazis doing before World War II, is they started hiring a bunch of street toughs and gangsters, because that sort of brings up the temperature of the movement, it gets everybody used to violence, and it also trains them in how to do violence. And so I don't think that a lot of these militia groups that we're seeing talking about the need for revolution, if there were to be a civil war, I don't think those are the groups that we'd really have to worry about. None of them is going to wind up taking over Washington, D.C. But if things get destabilized enough, existing political groups would have to militarize to support and protect their demographics. And that's where you see it turn from just internecine violence to an actual like civil war type situation.
So isn't it possible that the Republican Party loses the election, they're completely destabilized, and people think that the election was stolen, and they start recruiting? Or is that too far-fetched?
I can't imagine the Republican Party would do that, because the Republican Party is, you know, you've got a lot of guys, like Paul Ryan's not going to start.
He's a dangerous guy.
Yeah, he's not going to support an insurgency. But I think you would get groups that claim that they're standing for conservative values. They want to bring America back to the standards of our Constitution. They want to enforce, like they want it to be a Christian nation and whatnot. I think you would see groups forming like that and saying, like, we're going to protect Christians. We're going to protect... You know, I doubt they'd say we're out here to protect white people, but they'd say we're here to protect, you know, traditional Judeo-Christian values, or we're here to protect the Constitution, which you already have groups like the Oath Keepers who are saying, like, we don't want to start a revolution, but if the government stops respecting the Constitution, then we have to fight the government. It's our duty. That's the kind of thing I think you would see, rather than, I don't think you're going to see the Republican and Democratic parties start arming their supporters, but I think you might see... If there were to be massive police crackdowns, and you know those police crackdowns would probably hit harder on the black urban community than anyone else, because they always do for the entirety of the time there's been a black urban community. And I think you could see a group that's an offshoot of something like Black Lives Matter, with a lot of you know black military veterans or whatever, being like, well, we have to protect our communities, we have to protect our people, because we can't trust the government to do it, and because there's all these white militias out there starting shit, and then you know you've got another player in the fight.
Yeah, you had this screen cap of this YouTube video that was defeating drones, how to build a thermal evasion unit.
Thermal evasion suit. Clothing to make you invisible to a drone. And that was an Oath Keepers video.
Yeah, it's got 216,000 views.
Yeah, and the drone pilot, I spoke to a guy who was a drone pilot for a number of years, and he said that it was credible. Like it wasn't like a perfect solution. They were clearly exaggerating its efficacy, but if you were sitting still in one of those suits, you could hide yourself fairly well from a drone. And it certainly, again, lends credence to the fact that there's people with a lot of military experience out there who are coaching some of these movements in violence, you know, and the ability to effectively do it.
You can order that on Amazon.
You can make it yourself with some foil and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, space blankets.
I guess the last thing that jumped out to me from your article is sort of surprising, and what made the idea of a civil war much harder to just easily dismiss the way I had been dismissing it, is the idea that after the military would like capture people who had been part of the insurgency in Iraq and like ask them, hey, why were you cutting people's heads off, you fucking maniac? They were like, I don't know. Like, they couldn't recognize themselves. And that seems like a ass-covery response, but it actually, like, makes sense based on what we know of human psychology, right?
You see it everywhere. I mean, you saw it with German soldiers in World War II, people who were just, like, otherwise normal people who lived normal lives before and after that point, who did nightmarish things, because that's what happens when you get swept up and that sort of movement. And I think you're seeing a lot of the same things happening in Iraq right now with ISIS. You know, some of those people are legitimate psychopaths. Most of them are normal people who are doing what normal people do, which is kind of go with the flow. And if the flow is unspeakable violence, well, maybe you partake in some unspeakable violence. Especially if the people you're doing it against are people that you have demonized as lunatic, mountain-dwelling right-wingers or latte-sipping, effete, sinful liberals. As long as they're different enough from you, it's a lot easier to justify violence against them.
All right, let's do it. Let's go fight them.
All right.
All right. Anything else you guys wanted to talk about?
I don't think so. I hope we don't have a civil war.
Yeah, I don't think it's likely, but I think it's probably worth taking a step back and realizing that we're not on a safe road. Mm-hmm. Like there's some ice ahead, and we should maybe slow down and reevaluate what we're doing.
We should start doing like study abroad programs within the United States.
I think that's a good idea, actually.
A great idea.
I don't know why we don't do that. Europe does it.
I think more people from, you know, the effete left coast should move to spend some time in the rural south and get to know what can be awesome about that lifestyle, like getting drunk and shooting at cars, and also what's terrible about that lifestyle, like getting drunk and shooting at cars.
And shooting at cars.
Shooting at cars.
Oh, man, have you never shot a car, Jack?
Oh, my God.
Oh, wait, it's like wait, the car so doesn't have does people in it.
No. It's just an old derelict car, and you fill it with explosives, and you shoot
what?
At it. It's a hoot. Yeah.
Oh, my God, I would have loved to do that in high school.
Yeah, and I think more people from the rural south should come out here and
drink
walk the Santa
lattes.
Monica Pier, drink some lattes, smoke some of our great weed, and realize how nice life can be here. Like, there's upsides and downsides to the lives everybody lives around here. I think we just need to get better at seeing each other as people rather than political rivals and stereotypes.
Our lives could be one big Reese Witherspoon fish out of water, maybe.
We could all be sipping lattes and shooting at cars.
You right. can all wear crystals.
You yeah. could all learn to wear crystals. That's such a good idea, though, because I think the only reason we don't have that is because in Europe, they will go from one European country to another, and we just don't think of ourselves as separate countries. Because
they have Erasmus, and you can do it until you're, I think, 26.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's a study abroad program, but it's like sponsored by the EU, and you can go within the EU, and it's heavily subsidized.
Well, and one of the reasons the EU is the way it is after World War II, there was just this decision like, well, this can't happen again. Like, we have to figure out a way to stop this sort of nightmare from ever happening again. And everyone kind of settled on the best way is if everyone is able to travel around and meet every, like, Germany and France aren't going to try and murder each other again. If German kids are going to school in France and French kids are going to school in Germany, and everybody's got connections and friendships all across the continent. And that's why so many people started to get really scared. You know, not just the economic implications when the British pulled out. It's this, as flawed as the EU is, it also represents Europe unified in a way that it's never been. And Europe has, for most of history, been like a big bloody mess. And now it's not. And it's also the time in which they're all visiting and hanging out with each other. And it's probably connected that when people hang out and become buddies, they're less likely to start violent world-shattering wars.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That checks out.
Something to think about.
Weirdly, I feel like the different groups in America are even more isolated now than they've ever been, which shouldn't be the case because we have the internet, which is supposed to like break down barriers, but it seems like it's more reinforcing the differences.
Yeah, I know I have a lot of left-wing friends who only get fringe left-wing news in their Facebook feed, and their news comes from their Facebook feed. So they only see it if a friend posts it or if it's something that pops up because Facebook knows that you like reading the Daily Kos or whatever. And all my conservative Republican family members only see far right-wing news sources from Breitbart and the Daily Caller and the like because that's what their friends are sharing and that's what the internet knows they read. And I think that that further serves to separate and maybe even radicalize us.
Yeah, we need that program. Get on it, Teresa.
All right.
It's a great idea.
Give me a bonus. I'll start.
Clearly this falls on Kratt.
Yeah, it's Kratt's job.
I had a dream that you were mine. I've had that dream a thousand times. A thousand times. A thousand times. I've had that dream. A thousand times I left my room on the west side. Oh, from noon.
Hey guys, we're listening to A Thousand Times by Hamilton Lighthouser and Rostrum off their new collabo album, I Had a Dream You Were Mine. It's an awesome song that kind of evokes probably my favorite detail of Robert's article, where he pointed out that people in the Ukraine and Iraq, places where everything they know has been turned into a battleground, those people always say the same thing. It just seems like a bad dream, which reminds me of the month or so after September 11th and what moments of this election have actually felt like. That second debate, man. I had to like leave the room multiple times. It was just like too tense and upsetting for me. Anyways, hope you enjoyed this episode. Hope you're listening to it from the future, laughing at what a bunch of dramatic doofus sigh we were being for suggesting a second American Civil War was possible. Anyways, on to footnotes. We're going to link off to the article, obviously, 6 Reasons a new civil war is possible and terrifying. We'll link off to our personal experience article with somebody who goes undercover in a right-wing militia and how it ruined his life. We'll link off to a USA Today piece about the record number of anti-government militias in the USA right now. We'll link to the book, The Management of Savagery, The Cracked Podcast, which I hear is quite good, The 11 Nations of America, The 11 Nations of America Map, if you want to take a look at how the different regions of America break down, and of course, the video, How to Build a Thermal Evasion Suit, in case things go even worse than we were expecting. You're going to need to know that. Oh, and our next live show is coming up on Saturday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at UCB Sunset. Daniel O'Brien and Michael Swaim and I will be talking to a psychology expert about different pop psychology myths, things that you believe about how the human mind works that are bullshit. So, yeah, that should be fascinating. Tickets are only $5 as always, and there will be a link to the page where you can buy those tickets in the description of this episode. Hope to see you there. The shows almost always sell out pretty quickly, so get to the description quickly. Now, do it. I want to see you there. And yeah, that'll do it for this week. Thanks to engineer Brett Rader, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack_OBRIEN, and we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then.
Hey guys, it's Franklin Leonard, and we are back with another amazing season of The Blacklist Table Reads. We have so many ear movies for you this season and some fantastic talent at the helm. There is Paul Scheer starring in an insane action comedy.
Soak it in, Chucklehead. It's your last dance.
A dark new take on the story of Frankenstein with the incredible Joanne Froggatt.
It was the intoxication of your words that's kept me so tied to you, Mary.
And Aisha Tyler in AI apocalyptic sci-fi.
My name is Maggie. Mine is the story of great loss.
Plus interviews with our leads, writers, and much, much more. So listen in, subscribe to The Blacklist Table Reads right here on Earwolf.
Earwolf. This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.